are listening to Elevating Employee Experience. As always, I am your host, Josh Dreen, and I am joined here today by none other than Johnny Campbell, who's calling in from Dublin. How are you today, Johnny?
I'm good, Josh. It's a pleasure to be here, and thanks for having me on the show.
Listeners, if you don't know this, Johnny is the co-founder and CEO of Social Talent, the hiring skills platform. So, you know, the work from home and the future of work is very top of mind. How about we just start there, Johnny, and tell us a little bit about where you find passion in this industry and where we're headed.
So my background, just to give you briefly, Josh, I was a recruiter. I worked in staffing agencies for a few years, worked in the Caribbean for a couple of years, set up a recruitment agency in the last recession in 2008, and found myself almost 10 years ago founding a training company with my business partner, training organizations how to recruit better. Back when the last big change to our kind of way of hiring came about, which was due to not only the recession in 08, but also the growth of social media, which, you know, was the availability of online profiles, which weren't there before, showing people's jobs, professions, skills, employers, and that kind of stuff. So it was a big change. And we kind of rode that wave for the first part of our history, kind of sharing that knowledge and becoming the online platform for scale learning of how to hire in the kind of more modern way of doing it. So COVID and the pandemic and the recession that's happened this time around have, I think, kicked it into another new gear. 10 years later, another big, massive driving force. And the driving force there is fundamental. The biggest driving force is the work from anywhere or virtual working, revolution that I think is going to come out of this. You know, this unplanned experiment where we put almost all of the professional workforce of the world into remote working all at the same time. That's just unreal. And if it only lasted 4 weeks, I think it would have been just that weird time we all worked from home and then went back to our own ways. But I think it's accelerated something that was happening, but happening slowly over the previous decade. And from when I talk to leaders around the world, we work at large enterprises, many of them have already made statements publicly about the long term, and many others are planning to, where they're committing to a huge chunk of their workforce. I'm talking hundreds of thousands of employees per company will be working either fully remotely, which is not often the case, but at least most of the time working some way, working from anywhere. This WFA concept, which was the front page of the Harvard Business Review in the month we're recording this, December 2020. So I think that's the biggest shift, because it changes everything, you know, as we've all learned over the course of 2020.
It's truly a gift, is how I believe it. You know, we are forced to adapt. It's not like any other workforce change that I have ever experienced in my lifetime or of historic note. It just, everything has changed and we've had to change, right? Being thrown in the pandemic deep end, if you will, has changed work forever. So what kind of changes, what kind of positive changes are you seeing coming out of it?
Yeah, I'll clarify. I don't think it's not a gift. I don't think you meant it in that sense. Just to clarify, yeah, it is the travesty, this pandemic that's killed 1.5 million people and uprooted so many lives and caused a recession is just terrible. But, you know, I'm not somebody who dwells on the negative. You know, you got to deal with the negative, but you got to see the opportunity in this. You got to see the positivity, and you got to look past this, you know, terrible, you know, human disaster that's been 2020, and find those positive signs and roots. So when I kind of look at the opportunities and the positives, I think for many of us, it has meant that we have got back in touch with what's important. And that could be just on a personal level. You've spent more time with your partner, your friends, perhaps, if they live in the same household, or your family. You know, you're maybe not flying as much, traveling as much, probably not even spending as much, right? Because you just weren't able to consume. And you realized, I don't have to consume to just enjoy life. We all remember the early days of the first lockdown when we just went out and walks, and we kind of, you know, saw our neighborhoods and went into forests and we went to parks and we took up exercise and we got healthier. All those things are really, really, you know, they were the positive forces. But in the workplace, I think what it's done is it's really forced organizations, and particularly leaders, to take responsibility for the teams that they lead. I think many managers were managers because they were, you know, the top individual contributors. They were made a manager. And management was something that happened by accident. It wasn't terribly deliberate. They weren't good managers in that sense, because they just, you know, your employees would arrive, you'd have colleagues, you'd have other people in the business, and you just make things work. But when your employees that you're responsible for are literally sitting in their homes, at their kitchen tables, in their bedrooms, waiting for stuff to happen, you actually have to really, really work hard to make sure work gets done, to make sure they're motivated, engaged, their mental health is okay. So it really, you know, means that we, as leaders and managers, we actually have to do our job. And I don't think the majority of people knew how to do that. And in doing so, those of us who have perhaps begun to solve this, we're finding that it's an enjoyable job. It's hard work, but our employees, our colleagues are getting so much more out of it. The deliberate attention that you have to give to your team, the focus you have to give, the empathy, the compassion that maybe wasn't there in the past, you just need it. There's literally no excuse. You cannot get through this without trying to be a good leader. So that to me is one of the biggest benefits and positives to come out of this.
Yeah. You've made so many stringent points there that I want to tap on so many of them, but I love that piece at the end about empathy and kindness and kind of getting back to our human roots here. I feel like a lot of times HR is viewed as the process and the procedure, and we're finally getting to the human side of things. You know, as one of my mentors, Jason Averbuch, says, HR tech is now human tech. How do we leverage technology to be more human? And I feel like social talent is on that trajectory. You are doing that. So tell us a little bit about your platform and how we can how it helps in the future of work.
So I guess first thing we saw in March was that, you know, usage of our platform, which is an online learning platform, doubled. It tripled. You know, people were seeing that the only way they could learn was to go online. The other choices, which you know, for a lot of companies would be classroom training, informal training, they just vanished overnight. And so people still had a quest for information, more information, perhaps information in different areas. So, you know, our platform largely teaches the whole organizations how to hire. Now, hiring stopped in a lot of organizations back in March and April. It was just paralysis. But, you know, our users had new needs. So, for example, recruiters in organizations were trying to understand, how can I help my internal colleagues find new opportunities? Because our business model just changed or shifted. We've got to move people around. So internal career mobility became a thing. Many, many HR professionals and even recruiters were repurposed to try and fix the challenge of virtually onboarding colleagues. Parts of the world where, you know, you might have to serve a 2 or 3 month notice period. You had employees that were hired in February or January, were going to have to be onboarded in March, April, May, and there was no office to go to. There was restrictions in perhaps their countries on whether you could actually ship a laptop. Was that considered critical or not? And how do you actually enable somebody to get through a VPN process when you can't actually set their computer up? All of these challenges had to be solved. So they were all people challenges, human challenges. And what we found was that people had a quest for new information. So this is the concept of upskilling. Primarily, where they had to basically acquire brand new skills that are adjacent to their current skill set very, very quickly. And the only way you could do that was to go online. So we found that there was a huge demand for information, and there was a demand for new information from us, and we had to go produce that. And that's kind of, that was our kind of early COVID challenge, because we typically film that in studios with experts from around the world. Nobody could fly. Studios were closed. We had to figure it out. We had people filming in their homes, you know, trying to create professional studios in their bedrooms to try and, you know, get new content out as fast as possible. And, you know, for those of you who consume Netflix and Prime and Disney Plus, you get the whole world went crazy on content consumption. Podcast consumption went up. We're all consuming a lot more content than we used to. And fundamentally, that's what we are. We are a learning content organization built on a technology that is about getting to the right user at the right time. So people need that content. They've been striving for new learning. And, you know, we've just seen the pace of the demand for that knowledge and the expansion of the topics just explode since this started.
Yeah. And how important is that? I mean, you've been in the digital learning camp for a long time. What are the benefits? I know that, you know, we're all pivoting and all trying to discover how to make this work. What are the benefits and what are some practical ways that we can get better at digital learning?
So I just want to say, first of all, digital learning isn't the be all and end all, right? It's really, really a fantastic delivery system for learning. But learning is a little bit more complicated than that. And it hasn't been all solved digitally. So, you know, what we do, hopefully do well, is we scale learning to the right person. So we can get learning to the right person at the right time, and we can make it really high quality, you know, something that looks and feels more like you'd see on your favorite Netflix show. Really great speakers, high quality production, and really tight, bite-sized kind of training content. That contrasts with your typical traditional learning, which would be go into a classroom for 8 hours, have a couple of bathroom breaks, a coffee break, and a lunch break, and you just sit there and you take notes. And then when it's over, you're reliant on your handwritten notes days and weeks later to recall that information. You know, on-demand learning is available at scale to everybody. It's much less expensive to scale to whole organizations. Everyone in the world can learn at the same time. I can go back and rewatch that content whenever I want. I can get updates pushed to me. All of that stuff comes with digital learning. But it doesn't, you know, replace the need to socialize that in your group, to practice the techniques you've learned, to try and understand how that relates to the strategy of your business, perhaps in your team, what you're doing, having, you know, leadership support to encourage you to change your behaviors. All these things come with that. So we've had to, you know, look at digital tools that are necessary to drive that engagement. We started the hour talking about employee engagement. Employee engagement is so important. And we need to get learner engagement up as well. And learners want to understand relevance. They want to know why they're learning this content. They want to know how they can put it into practice. And they want to have recognition for that. So there's a whole ecosystem that goes into the badging, recognition, the culture of learning, having the right learning objects and types. That's fascinating. And to me, as somebody who came to this industry 10 years ago, having no background in learning, you know, I was a recruiter. It's been fascinating. And I think you look at digital learning, the benefits are certainly much, much better in terms of scale. You can access so much more information. You can have the world's best speaker in your pocket. There's downsides though. You know, there's a great camaraderie that comes with sitting in a classroom with 5 or 6 people and getting to know them and having a conversation about what's going on. You can replicate some of that online, but not all of it. But really it's about trying to figure out where in the learning process is digital the absolute best way to go, and where can you then put human interaction in place, because that's better as well, and getting that balance right.
Yeah. Oh, so great. You know, it's interesting that as I've observed my own behavior, the behavior of my children, the behavior of others that I'm interacting with, it feels like as we're doing this digital learning, whether it's, you know, in a classroom or just watching a video, there's a level of multitasking that happens. It feels like we are watching the video while answering emails, while on Slack, while doing everything. And do you feel like that is just the new norm? Do you feel like that gets in the way of learning? And so where does multitasking fit as we try to learn?
I don't believe in multitasking. You know, I must just kind of call that out. So I think most of us are omnitaskers. You know, we just think we're multitaskers, and there's high switching costs from switching from one task to another and back again. You have the illusion of multitasking, but really what you're doing is you're working on one task, stopping, switching to another, stopping, switching back again. And for most tasks, that's just not a good idea. Get something done, focus, move on. And I think it's been hard for some folks to do that in the original kind of days of the pandemic. But I'd argue that, you know, we're more focused, you know, in our team, in our business, we're just more focused. Because you aren't having the distraction of somebody asking you by walking up to your desk or popping over and asking you to do something, you're more focused on the plan. You know, we use OKRs, objectives and key results, as our kind of management technique every quarter. And we've never been better at focusing on those. We're not perfect, but we've never been better. You get more focused on project management. You line up your day and schedule it more. So I think people are busier, but I do think they're more focused and they're getting things done and they're able to kind of map that out. Now, I say that, and I must kind of caveat it by saying there's those folks who are still reacting. I mean, they're struggling to keep their head above water because, you know, their business is in real trouble or their roles are in trouble. It is hard to get things done well when you're in that kind of position. But I'm talking about if you've come out of that, if you're lucky enough to have come out of that. I actually think that we're more focused. But I think multitasking is a myth. I think people who try and pursue multitasking as a strategy are fooling themselves, and they're ignoring the switching costs, the high switching costs that have often come with that approach.
Wow. I definitely feel like that is a calling me out onto the carpet, because it's so true. I realize why I can't get this project done is because I'm simultaneously working on so many things, but it's like the cost of switching really is like, a whole new mindset, and you know, you've got your attention divided. So I love that emphasis on deep learning and getting your task done, moving on that. Are there any strategies for those who might struggle in this new digital learning landscape?
So I listened to a great podcast. I don't know if you listened to the A16Z, the Andreessen Horowitz podcast.
Yes.
And there was, I think it would be Mark Andreessen was talking about this challenge in education and focus. And, you know, he's being a bit glib, but he was saying, you know, there's a fantastic, amazing piece of technology that's available to help you manage this. And the colleague who was interviewing was saying, well, what is that? And he said, it's called Google Calendar. And the colleague said, what do you mean? He's like, you know, to-do lists are bad. And I've felt this for a long time. To-do lists don't work because what they fail to ignore is the restriction that we have on time. Time is the one resource that none of us can buy more of. We're all restricted in time. And therefore, we have to manage your time correctly. And a to-do list doesn't help you manage your time. It helps you prioritize, but not manage your time. I've used Calendar for years to take my to-do list and put it in my calendar. That way it gets done. How long will that take? I'll book in 30 minutes, book in 90 minutes. But I also calendar other stuff because, you know, one of the downsides of COVID from an employee perspective is burnout. We're all working so much harder. We're taking the commute time and putting it into work. You need to actually book in that time. I book in time to go to the cinema, go to the movies with my friends, have dinner, take the kids to sports or whatever. So like my calendar is where I map out everything. You can see everything I'm doing pretty much every hour. I book in my lunch, I book in a coffee break, you know, which might be your bathroom break. But you need to realize that your time is precious and plan it. That's how you get things done. It won't get done if it's not in my calendar. If I have something on a to-do list, but it hasn't been put into my calendar, it's a waste of time having it on my to-do list. So, you know, I'll use the Andreessen Horowitz philosophy of the best piece of software you can help you around time management is the good old free Google Calendar or Outlook Calendar or whatever the equivalent is. And take your to-do list and start mapping it into your calendar. It's the only way you'll get stuff done.
Such a powerful, powerful way to look at it. You know, I was using a paper planner, you know, kind of born in the Franklin Covey generation where you pull out the big thing on your desk. It's got the quotes up in the corner. And it took me a long time, to be honest, to let it go. I had a little one that fit in my pocket. But man, once I transitioned to digital calendaring, it changed everything. And I think you're absolutely right. And we don't have to overthink it either. These are great tools to help us just be more efficient, not to take over our lives. And so I love that approach. You know, Johnny, this has been just a fantastic conversation with you. As we start to wrap things up, what is a rallying call you can leave us with of anyone who is drinking the Kool-Aid now, wants to get started, but isn't quite sure what to do next?
So when I think of our challenges going into next year, for many of us, you know, 2020 is about getting just short-term decision-making done and getting on with tasks, right? And that's great. And, you know, you needed to be that way for some time. But we are living in a world that still has so much uncertainty. So there may be vaccine coming, you know, or arriving very soon, arriving in the next few months. But the reality is it could be 3 years before those vaccines are distributed around the world to everybody. And so therefore, there's going to be a lot of uncertainty continuing for the next while about when we're going back to work, when we can return to more normal conditions. So the best thing to do to provide more certainty is to start planning for the long term. And I would do that both in your personal life and your work life. The short term is hard to plan for. You don't really know. So therefore, we get by. But you can absolutely start planning for the next year, 2 years ahead. What do you want to achieve in work or in your personal life in the next 3 years? Absolutely, we can plan for that because we've more certainty to know what the world will look like in 3 years. It's going to look like, you know, probably beyond COVID. We'll have moved on, hopefully, from this. But in 1 year, I have no idea where we'll be. But if you take that kind of time horizon, whether you're a leader planning with your team, getting your team involved, the act of being able to plan with a little bit more certainty about more of a long-term future is actually cathartic. I think it's a really good thing for us to do because there's so much stress involved in uncertainty in the short term. Let's not try and fix that because it's not fixable. Something we can get our heads around is perhaps more long-term planning. Strategic thinking and long-term planning took a backseat in 2020 across the world. It's time to bring it back because it's not just good for you and your business. It's just good for your soul, for your mental health to go, I have a plan. I have kind of long-term goals. I know why I'm doing this. So that's my piece of advice I'd leave people with.
Ah, so inspiring. Johnny Campbell, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us on the show. How can our listeners keep in touch with you?
Well, you can find me anywhere in the world you want on social, whether it's Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, wherever, Twitch. Just search Johnny Campbell. Or if you want to keep up to date with some of the great knowledge from the speakers on our platform, some of our fantastic colleagues in our content team, you can subscribe to our blog at socialtalent.com.